This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Election day is here. Candidates across the state are vying for seats in Orlando and other cities. Governor Rick Scott's touting more tax cuts. He also visited Puerto Rico for the second time in recent days to check on the pace of their hurricane recovery. And meanwhile, there's turmoil in Tallahassee. Lawmakers in the state capital say they've been spied on by a private investigator. Well, joining us to discuss more on the latest in Sunshine State politics, a former state representative, Dick Batchelor. Welcome back, Dick.
Thank you.
Also joined by Republican political commentator Michelle Urtel. Michelle, welcome back to you.
Hello.
Let's start with municipal elections in Orlando. District 3, Robert Stewart faces a challenge from attorney Asima Azam. Dick Batchelor, what can you tell me about Azam?
Well, she's a lawyer, and she's raised almost as much money as the incumbent has, which puts that as probably the most competitive race other than the other district we'll talk about. But she's a strong candidate, and they've been having a lot of debates around the district. I guess if I had to choose one, I would choose Mr. Stewart because Robert's the incumbent and carries some sway there. But she's been very, very competitive, so it could turn out to be a close race. But I think he has the edge at this point as the incumbent.
If you drive through Baldwin Park, you will see a lot of yard signs for Asima Azam, and there was some controversy over that, apparently some allegations or a claim by Stewart that there were not the right kind of disclaimers on those signs.
Yeah. It's been going back and forth. There's some issues, but not the big issues. But the big issues they seem to be similar on, you know, planning, transportation, neighborhood improvement, those kind of things.
Okay, so there's another race which is drawing a lot of attention. District 5, six candidates lining up against incumbent Regina Hill. Why is this district so interesting? Why so much competition here?
Well, there's so many candidates in this race, it'll most likely be a runoff because I don't know if anyone can carry 50% plus one, including the incumbent Regina Hill. Regina, though, has raised about $55,000, so she's doing well. Erica Dunlap, another candidate in the race, is a former Miss America. She's raised about $34,000. She's got a lot of support in that community. So there's most likely going to be a runoff in December for this race.
Do you get the sense, Dick Batchelor, that Regina Hill has made some missteps in her time as commissioner? Like, do her opponents sense some weakness there?
Well, they must, or they wouldn't be running. But the fact is, she's very popular in her district. I know she was very controversial the first time she ran. Her background, she was arrested 26 times.
She was pretty open about that, though.
Pretty open about it. Had her voter rights reinstated, became a candidate, got elected. Mm-hmm. But the mayor's endorsed her, Mayor Buddy Dyer's endorsed her, so that's strong. And he said that she's really focused on the community, bringing things to the community, the Paramore district in particular. And while she's going to be hard to beat, it looks like a runoff with that many candidates in the race.
Speaking of Dyer, he's going to be sticking around in local politics for a little bit longer, it seems.
Looks like it. He was wanted to be in the room to be president of the University of Central Florida, but he's now set it aside and is going to run for election again.
Well, let's move to Tallahassee. Michelle Urtel.
Do we have to?
it's been a crazy couple of weeks.
Right. There's been some turmoil up there. I mean, there have been allegations of spying. A private investigator apparently planted a camera in an apartment that was frequented by lobbyists and lawmakers. What's going on there?
Well, I think there's a lot of finger pointing. It's not solely Democrat, although we did have a Democrat resign under accusations of an extramarital affair. We've got a Republican now being looked at closely. It's like a circular firing squad, and who knows how this is going to end. It's very ugly. There are lines apparently have been crossed between lobbyists and elected officials, and allegations of somebody going to Tallahassee to represent his district, and it's common to say, oh, yes, this is his Tallahassee wife, and that's his real wife back home. And that's just been the culture of Tallahassee, and all of the blood and gore is starting to come out, and it's going to become public.
It's going to be very serious ramifications. The other senator we're talking about, Senator Latvala, who's a candidate for governor of all things. Politico has interviewed eight women accusing him of sexual misconduct. Senator Nagon, the Senate president, has now appointed an independent investigator to look at this. I don't see how he survives. I don't think he can survive a governor's race with this taint. Mm-hmm. But the real thing, and there's so many aspects of this, so who put in the video camera? Mm-hmm. What was their motive? Were they trying to nail anybody else involved in these activities? Were they captured Senator Latvala on the video kissing in the mouth a lobbyist? I don't know how you survive this kind of thing.
It's going to be hard. But what I find particularly interesting about Senator Latvala and the Senate right now is he holds the purse strings. So right now, nobody wants to rock the boat with him because they want to be able to bring money back to their communities. And, and I don't know that Senator Latvala is a kind of man who would retaliate, but were I a senator, I don't know that I'd want to take that chance. Do you agree with that, Dick?
I agree with that. Keep in mind, Senator Jeff Clemens, who was incoming minority leader.
And this
Democrat,
is the senator who resigned after.
And he resigned. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of set a precedent, if there's anything. And now let's see how the investigation unfolds. But when you've got eight women coming forward talking now in a special investigator in a videotape, I mean, it's not pretty.
What about the timing then? Because Senator Latvala says, this is just an attempt to derail my gubernatorial campaign. What do you make of that?
Well, it very well could be. I wouldn't put it past an opponent to set somebody up. But we have very good reporters. We've got Politico. We've got Mark Caputo and Matt Dixon, who I respect very much. I think, Dick, you probably respect them. They're very
absolutely
neutral, good reporters. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that this is, in fact, and they did name one of the women. And there's the videotape. And so, there's a lot of smoke. Again, nobody knows until this investigation is complete. But for right now, it's not looking good for Jack Latvala.
Dick Batchelor, what about other lawmakers? Could this be a cleaning house?
Well, it could be. The fact is, now that Jeff Clemens is out and Senator Latvala is under investigation, again, who videotaped him and what was their reason for doing that? And did he do it on behalf of another candidate for governor? We don't know any answer to any of these questions yet.
Well, one name that's been floated is a former lawmaker, Frank Artiles, right?
Yes, absolutely, because he had to leave the Senate too. Mm-hmm. I think other names will come out. I mean, people are going to try to jump ship, and there will probably be some finger pointing. So it's not over yet, as Michelle says. It's just beginning.
If there is this toxic culture in Tallahassee, though, where lines are being crossed, there are relationships that are inappropriate. Could this be good for the culture?
Yeah, I think Senator Negron, in fact, has come out very, very strongly and basically said, we're not going to tolerate this. In fact, Speaker Corcoran has basically come out and said, if you've ever been accused of it, you should resign. Anybody should resign. So, yeah, there could be some house cleaning in, but they need to get this over and done with because they got to focus on, a substantial budget and legislative session.
Mm-hmm. Well, if we could move from there to other factors in the gubernatorial race, then we have not quite candidate John Morgan tweeting at gubernatorial candidates to get their thoughts on medical marijuana.
Right.
What do you make of this, Dick Batchelor?
He's going to stay on that issue, of course. That's his primary issue. He's also moved off and said he wanted to basically have a 15-hour minimum wage. He got beat up a little bit by the Orlando Weekly, basically saying, we've checked and you're only paying $12 an hour for your employees to answer your phone, so maybe you should pay $15 an hour, which is just an indication that, you can't be a one-issue campaigner mm-hmm. for governor. So whether or not he gets it, I don't know. But I think with Mayor Levine getting in, he has a personal net worth of $100 million. He's kind of alluded to the fact that he might spend $25 million. Gwen Graham, who would be the fundraiser with the name recognition, she's only raised about $3 million. So if he drops $25 million, he becomes the automatic front runner in that governor's race.
And what could be particularly interesting with that is with Levine, and then if Morgan gets in with his personal wealth, man,
yes,
that will be one to watch.
Yes.
What about the likes of Andrew Gillum, mayor of Tallahassee?
Well, he's not doing great. He's got some trouble. It's, mm-hmm. He is mayor of a city with an incredibly high crime rate.
Yep.
And right now he's in third place, according to a Florida Politics poll. He's in second place, excuse me,
right,
with 13%. Gillum's in second place, mm-hmm. Graham in first, Levine is in third, and King is in fourth. And
this, fourth, right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that the mayor, unfortunately, and I like him a great deal, Mayor Gillum, unfortunately, there's been an FBI investigation of this city of Tallahassee.
And that just, he hasn't been able to shake that.
and his fundraising dried up. And while he has appeared to be innocent of anything, he's not been charged with anything, anytime in politics, if you mention FBI investigation candidate, it doesn't come across good at all.
Those words don't go well in a headline.
They do not go well in headlines, even though he hasn't been accused of anything or proven of doing anything wrong. The fact is your campaign financing, your fundraising just dries up.
Okay. If you look over onto the Republican ticket, Michelle Ertel, Adam Putnam still the front runner there?
He's still the front runner. You know, I think that it will be between Adam Putnam and I was going to say Jack Latvala up until this happened. Richard Corcoran is said to be getting into the race, Speaker of the House. And then there's Congressman Ron DeSantis, who is on Fox News every single day getting FaceTime. And he is very well liked in the party. He is very conservative. And, you know, I think everybody just assumed all along that it was going to be Adam Putnam. But if Ron DeSantis gets in, I think he could really give him a run for his money. Mm-hmm. Now, after the primary, you know, Democrats have to remember that for 20 years, Republicans have held that seat. So they've got the fundraising advantage and they've got a powerhouse. They know how to get people elected to governor.
I think they expected, with Latvala in the race, being the more moderate between Putnam and Corcoran, that he would kind of maybe divide it in the primary and have a chance at it. But I agree with Michelle that I don't see how he survives. But if the congressman gets in the race, it's going to be a very interesting race, particularly with Corcoran, because he's extremely conservative too.
Speaking of Governor Rick Scott, he's made a couple of visits now to Puerto Rico. He's been quite out front as far as being seen to do what he can to help them get things back up and running. And they are still in bad shape in Puerto Rico, still most of the island without power, still trying to get that back on. Michelle Ertel, what do you make of the optics of Governor Scott kind of leading here?
Well, because Governor Scott is welcoming a whole lot of Puerto Rican residents to Florida. And he's going over there, and he doesn't know whether these residents that we have here now are going to be permanent residents. But he would like for them, and we all would, to give them the opportunity to go home if they wish. And so Governor Scott going over there, I think, is very helpful as far as optics go. Whether someone likes Governor Scott or doesn't like Governor Scott, There's very little argument that he hit a home run in dealing with Irma. And I think him showing up in Puerto Rico is a good thing.
Dick Batchelor, did Democrats see that the same way? Was it a home run for Governor Scott?
He got very high marks as governor in responding to Irma. And the optics are exactly the way Michelle put him. I mean, he's running for U.S. Senate. He got to Puerto Rico a couple of times. You are out front. The best thing ever happened to him politically was the hurricane. I hate to say that, but he kept on TV all the time. The most recent poll has the incumbent United States Senator Bill Nelson neck and neck with Governor Scott, who definitely will be in the race. The one factor we don't know, and there are going to be registered Democrats, Puerto Ricans, but how many we don't know. I think it's too early to tell that now. But the real factor, in my opinion, is going to be the popularity of the president, because Governor Scott has tied himself very closely to Trump. Trump's at 33% now in the national polls, but he's still at about 68% amongst Republicans, so he's very strong with that base there. So I think that's going to be a factor way down the road, but right now the optics, I think the governor's playing it right. He's come a long way since his first year in office.
And meanwhile, Michelle, Governor Scott touring around touting tax cuts.
Well, Rick Scott is all about cutting taxes, as is the president right now. So whenever you go around talking to the public about tax cuts, you're going to get a big old thumbs up.
Michelle Ertel, Republican political commentator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Dick Batchelor, former Democratic state representative, thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
Still to come on Intersection.
I got back in the car because I have the best of the best behind me. I have Florida Tech doing all the research. I have my husband who leads a great team at Larson Motorsports. And I have my crew chief, man. Paige keeps me safe. She gave me a safe race car to get down the track every single time.
Not your average internship. Florida Tech interns with Larson Motorsports face challenges like keeping the driver safe when their jet-propelled car crashes at 280 miles per hour. Don't miss a minute of Intersection. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Listen on the NPR One app or visit our website, WMFE.org. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. That's the sound of a jet dragster firing up its engines. From the education desk this week on Intersection, what it takes to pilot a car that can go from 0 to 280 miles per hour in 5.5 seconds, and how to keep the driver safe. We'll talk to the founder of Larson Motorsports and two interns at a drag racing team, 20-year-old driver in training Kat Redner, who's studying journalism at the Florida Institute of Technology, and 24-year-old pit crew chief Paige Sanchez, who has a master's degree in mechanical engineering and is working on a PhD in aviation sciences. Elaine Larson drives jet dragsters. She's the co-founder and president of Larson Motorsports, and she's also mentoring a new generation of drag racers and technicians through a partnership with the Florida Institute of Technology. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. This is really exciting for us to be able to bring what we do out into the world.
We're also joined by Kat Redner. She is a driver in training. She's a Florida Tech student. Thank you for joining us as well, Kat.
Thank you for having us.
And Paige Sanchez, she's a crew chief and also a Florida Tech student. Thank you as well, Paige.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here.
Elaine, I want to start with you. Just explain what a jet dragster is and how fast can you get it to go?
Okay, so this is like a landlocked missile. This car goes 0 to 100 in 1 second, 0 to 280 miles an hour in only 5.5 seconds. We use a jet engine, a General Electric J85 out of a T-38, a little fighter trainer that we put on this landlocked missile, and it is so much fun. My job goes a quarter mile at a time at 280 miles an hour.
How far do you, like, how far is a course for one of these races?
So the actual drag strip is only 1,320 feet, and then I usually get about twice that to be able to stop. I have to use a custom cross-form parachute to be able to stop this car in a very short distance.
So just explain what it's like getting into the driver's seat of one of these and going that fast. Is there any comparison to it?
There sure isn't. You know, I think that a lot of people, you could maybe kind of say it's like on a roller coaster, only you're in control. You know, you always get those butterflies when you get into the car. I'm restrained by 12 points of restraint. There's a lot of engineering and human factors that kind of goes into this driver's compartment, my office. And you fire this thing up and you just point and aim it and hope for the best at the end of the racetrack.
So as far as controlling it, it's basically just making sure it's going in a straight line?
Absolutely. This car is thrust driven. The engine is going to produce about 5,000 pounds of thrust. We use a custom afterburner that we build at our shop. And if you point it straight, she's probably going to go that way. Now, there's always variations. If there's a crosswind or, you know, a bump in the track or something like that, if you have to steer out of it. But pretty much it's point and aim and shut her off on time.
Okay, let me bring you into this conversation, Kat Redner. What's it like being a driver in training? It sounds quite exciting.
So being a driver in training, it's a bit nerve-wracking because I've never driven a race car before. The fastest thing I've driven was a V6 Mustang before I got into a jet car. So it was definitely an experience. Getting in, it's always, you have to calm yourself down when you get in the car, and then you just focus on that finish line and the point to stop. And when the parachute comes out, it's just pure relief.
So how much practice do you have to do before they actually say, okay, you're good to go, we're going to put you in the car by yourself and you can take control?
So we have to do quite a bit of practice. Chris Larson, Elaine's husband, actually does a training course for a few days, so you get to know all about the jet car. After that, Elaine gets you in the car, has you start it up and make some fire. Then you do engine only, so you take it to the track and then it's all on you. And engine only is a little bit slower. Well, it's a lot slower than lighting the afterburner. So it just gets you into the ease of driving the car and making sure you know what you're doing before you light the afterburner, which creates a lot more power and has you go a lot faster. So after you do the engine only, you do the afterburner and you go about 280.
What was it like for you the first time you switched on that afterburner? You said it was a bit nerve-wracking being a driver in training. What was kind of going through your head just before you fired that thing up?
What was going through my head was probably just focusing on the point to shut off the car. I was just focusing on that finish line, and I pulled the parachute and throttle back, and the parachutes came out, and it was a great feeling.
And when you let those parachutes go, is it a slow sort of roll out, or is it a bit bumpy?
It's a pretty big bump, but I like it because you know that parachute is stopping you, and it's relieving to feel that.
So are you looking at this as a career, or is it just a, you know, part of the degree you're doing?
I am actually looking at this as a career because I love going to the racetrack, meeting fans, seeing all the different people, and it's just a lot of fun getting to teach little kids about STEAM and STEM education with what we do with the Jet Dragsters, because there's so much of that in what we do there.
Okay, so Paige Sanchez, you're also part of the program at Florida Institute of Technology with Larson Motorsports. Tell me about what goes into being a crew chief for a drag racing team.
Being a crew chief for Larson Motorsports is no simple task. I basically have Elaine's life in my hands. When I tighten those nuts and bolts on the race car, it's going to go 280 miles an hour, and her safety is all up to me. So I'm responsible for the pre- and post-race inspections on the car. I'm responsible for all the equipment at the track, which includes the truck and the trailer and the vehicle. And then back at the shop, we have to pay so much attention to detail. So we tear apart these cars, inspect it inch by inch to make sure everything is race ready. So it's a pretty huge job.
And you'd have to know quite a bit about jet engines too, right? So it's not just your average race car. There's something a little special about this one.
Right. I'm a mechanical engineer, so I didn't exactly learn jet engines in college. But the one great thing about our team is we have so many people on our team that have specializations. So I might not have to know every single thing on the car to be a crew chief. My main focus is more structurally. That's what I went to school for. But we have people on the shop that make this team go. So we have people at the shop that work on the engines, that work on the chassis, fabrication, paintwork. So I feel like we all have a pretty big hand in each of these race cars.
How much variation can there be in a drag racing car? And Elaine, this might be something you can weigh in on as well. Like, how many sort of modifications can you make to the vehicle before you're kind of in a different category or something?
So in a jet car, there's a lot of different fine tuning that you can get. You know, I'm a girl and I like diamonds, but in my jet car, I love shock diamonds. And what that means is the gases contract and expand when they go through the engine as they come out the afterburner, and you can see these little rings. So what Paige has to do is she has to control the fuel, the air that's getting into the engine, and being able to harness all that power that's going through the engine. So she really takes in effect of the elevation, you know, the humidity, the weather, the atmosphere, and then she gives me the best tuned car that she can and tells me what I need to do to get down the track.
Paige, let me come back to you for a moment. I understand you've been interested in racing for quite some time and also pursuing a career in engineering. What's it like now being able to put those two things together and put the theory into action?
Honestly, it's a dream come true. I never thought I would be in drag racing, especially jet drag racing. I was always a huge NASCAR fan growing up. And I always wanted to be a race engineer for a NASCAR team. But then when I got to college, Larson Motorsports was right down the street. And little did I know that I would be an IHRA Jet Car World Championship with Elaine Larson. And so to be only in my early 20s and to have a championship under my belt working with the best in the business, I can't even put this into words. One huge thing about Larson Motorsports is mentoring the younger generation. So as soon as I stepped in there, I literally had no hands-on experience. I was always a straight-A student that knew the math and the science, but when it came to race cars and actually working on them, I had pretty much zero knowledge. So coming into the shop, they taught me everything I need to know from the ground up, from welding to working with tools to fabrication, you name it, and they pretty much taught me everything that I know about the race car.
How's it been working with those other folks in the team? Are they happy to have a student and sort of help mentor you and show you the ropes?
Yeah, definitely. I feel like that's one thing that Larson Motorsports really prides ourselves on is this mentorship program. It is so rewarding for both the mentor and the mentee, and I feel like we're all learning along the way. And I think having students in the shop really gives that engineering perspective. So Larson Motorsports, they're a race team. We don't have engineers working on the race team or technicians. And so to have that engineering perspective, doing the modeling, doing the analysis, it really sheds a whole new light in what we do out on the racetrack.
You were talking about responsibility just before. You're talking about the responsibility, making sure that, you know, the car's functioning well and obviously your driver is safe. But what about winning? You're also thinking about how the team is doing. Does that put a little bit of pressure on you as well?
Yeah, absolutely. What we do is the real deal. It's not a collegiate competition that we're trying to win in one little competition. This is throughout the course of a year. This is throughout the course of multiple years. So what we're doing, we're competing with the big dogs in the industry, and that's a lot of pressure. We have everyone looking at us, especially being women in the industry. So it definitely adds some pressure, but I think the best part about it is that it is real, and we are working with these people that have been racing their entire lives, and it's really humbling to be a small college student in such a huge sport and that I get to play a small part in it.
Elaine Larson, tell me about what got you involved or interested in drag racing from the get-go, because you've been doing this for like 20 years now.
I sure have. What got me started was the husband, man. He loved things that went fast. He has the aerospace background. He's a pilot. He's a mechanic. He's an engineer. He's a little bit of everything. And he brought me into his world of going fast in these high performance vehicles. So 25 years ago, I hopped in a race car and never looked back and always wanted to go faster. About, 7 years ago, I ended up hitting a wall at 280 miles an hour. And, you know, as racing enthusiasts, we always look at these wrecks differently. When you're a fan, you're like, wow, look at the big fire. But when you're a team or a driver or a crew, it's a whole different perspective. And I think what I love best about our team is that we looked at things differently. And that's what brought us here to Florida Institute of Technology. They're a full-on research university. They're looking at foam implementation. They're looking at driver's compartment. You know, how do we keep our drivers safer? And we come up with a real-world problem. We take it to Florida Tech, and they research it and come back and give us their thoughts. So we're taking what we do into a whole next generation and bringing this next generation in here to hopefully be better, safer, faster. And Kat's looking to kick my butt, I'm sure, but she's going to have to work really hard because Paige and I, we've got the winning champ 2 times in a row. So I've taught her everything that I know except maybe 1 or 2 tricks.
Elaine Larson, how do you walk away from a 280-mile-an-hour crash with a rocket strapped onto the back of your car? That sounds like a tricky proposition.
It sure is. You know, in the good times, everything are good. But when things go bad, it's amazing how quickly everything can unfold. And luckily, we had engineered a really safe driver's compartment, and I did walk away. I ended up with a subdural hematoma, a head injury, which Paige, my crew chief, really took serious. She looked at, you know, where I got hurt, what made me get hurt, and how could she make me safer. So not only does she crew my car on the weekends, during the week, she looks at how she can make my car safer. And she does a lot of research on that, from foam to extra chassis around me or, you know, whatever it's going to take. I got back in the car because I have the best of the best behind me. I have Florida Tech doing all the research. I have my husband who leads a great team at Larson Motorsports. And I have my crew chief, man. Paige keeps me safe. She gave me a safe race car to get down the track every single time.
Did it take you a while to get back into racing mode, though? I'm just wondering if there's a bit of trepidation, you know, the next time you set out to race, knowing that you had that crash in your rearview mirror.
You know, when I was in the hospital, I knew I had some choices to make. And I'm sitting here the first day, I'm thinking I'm never going to get back. But I literally raced to eat. Okay, so this is how I make my living, is racing. And the first day I said, oh, no, I'm done. Second day, I thought, you know, it might not be so bad. But by the third day, I'm saying, where's my fire suit? So literally 6 weeks after I got out of the hospital, I was back in the car and I've never looked back. It is way harder, though, putting a young girl like Kat Renner's only 20 years old. I'm putting this young girl in this race car, knowing what it could potentially do to her. And that's way scarier than what the race car could ever do to me. You know, I love these kids just like they're my own. And, you know, it's tough to know that you have trained them with the knowledge, but are they going to have the ability to get that car safe and sound down the track?
Let me ask too about the other drivers. Like, how many women drivers are there in this business?
In jet racing, there's probably only about 6 or 7 of us. There's not that many. In racing in general, especially drag racing, there's quite a few more. There's a small handful, 50, 60 that are in the pro limb, you know, the pro game. Hundreds more in the sportsman level. I think that women have been coming up through the ranks, not only in driving, but Paige is, like, she's blazing new trails being a crew chief. That's the part that I love. You know, as a driver, we get all the fame, the fortune, hopefully, and we get all the TV time. But for me, I'm only the person who holds the steering wheel. I couldn't even get my car to the track by myself. I couldn't even get my car started by myself. My crew means everything to me. They start from the day they come up with the concept of the design. They start from when they bend that first piece of chrome moly around me. And, you know, they're the real heroes. I just kind of make them look good if I get the car down the starting or down the racetrack.
So what are you hoping that this will lead to? Do you want to see more drivers, more women behind the wheel of these jet drag races? Do you want to see more crew chiefs like Paige?
You know, what I hope is that it plants a seed. I hope that it plants a seed that will grow to make these young next generation kids to say, you know, if Elaine, Kat, and Paige can do this, what can I do? Whether that path leads them into jet racing, rockets, I mean, you know, we're launching things in space all the time. I want them to push their boundaries. I want them to think outside the box and, you know, go for their passion and know that nothing can stop them except their own fear. If you have the guts, you can go for the glory. And that's what I hope. I'd love to have them all come to my shop and come to Florida Tech and, you know, be the next jet racing, you know, spectacular person. But, you know, if their path leads them in a different direction, that's awesome. Just to know that we potentially had a part in that.
Well, Elaine Larson, drag racer, co-founder and president of Larson Motorsports, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us. This is a dream to be able to give back to this, you know, Paige and Kat. And, you know, you have to follow us on our social media sites and stuff because we do a lot of really fun stuff. We're going to be out racing real soon and hopefully at a track near you guys.
Paige Sanchez, she's a crew chief. She's also a Florida Tech student. Thank you so much, Paige.
Yes, thank you so much. It was a joy to be here.
And Kat Redner, driver in training with Larson Motorsports and also Florida Institute of Technology student. Thank you so much, Kat.
Thank you for having us.
Still to come on Intersection.
The season started off on a 6-1 run, the best start to any MLS season that Orlando City has had since joining in 2015. And then just kind of, it wasn't all at once. It was just little by little, just not getting the wins, not getting the goals, thinking and feeling that they were going to break out of it and never doing it. So the season overall as a whole is a disappointment for them. They missed the playoffs again for the third consecutive year and not a lot of happy people.
Orlando City Soccer's superstar Kaká is gone and the team is rebuilding. So what's next for the franchise? If you missed an episode of Intersection, listen back on our website, wmfe.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast, find that on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can listen to the NPR One app. We're back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Orlando City Soccer started last season well, with a new coach, new players, and a winning streak. But overall, 2017 was a bumpy ride. The team didn't make the playoffs. Now the franchise is facing a future that doesn't include superstar Kaká, who announced that he won't be returning in 2018. Still, the Orlando City CEO is sticking by the coach, Jason Christ, who was hired back in 2016. With us in the studio for a look back at last season and what's ahead, Orlando Sentinel sports reporter Alicia Delgello. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So just take a look back at the season. How has it gone? Did fans kind of go into it with high hopes, and were those hopes a little bit dashed?
Yes, definitely. All of that. Fans went into it with huge hopes for the new season. It was the first season, full season, that Jason Christ had as a head coach, brought in some new players. The season started off on a 6-1 run, the best start to any MLS season that Orlando City has had since joining in 2015. And then just kind of, it wasn't all at once. It was just little by little, just not getting the wins, not getting the goals, thinking and feeling that they were going to break out of it and then never doing it. So the season overall as a whole is a disappointment for them. They missed the playoffs again for the third consecutive year, and not a lot of happy people.
There are some pretty dedicated City fans, though, right? I mean, there's a couple of clubs. They go to the pretty much every single game. You can see them down the end of the pitch. Do you think there might be a little fall off in attendance for those clubs looking into next season?
I don't think next season. I think next season they'll be rejuvenated and hopeful again. But there was definitely a little bit of a fall off in the last couple of games of this season. Mm-hmm. Rather than sellouts, the 25,500 people in the stadium, you'd see numbers, and this is announced attendance, so the numbers were probably even a little bit lower than this. You'd see the numbers around the 23, 22, 24 mark. So mm-hmm. there was a little bit of a fall off there.
Okay, so what went wrong? What do you think the post-mortem of the season looks like from the Orlando City perspective?
Yeah, it's really hard to just pinpoint one thing that went wrong. It was just a whole host of things. If you ask the coach, he gave reasons ranging from losing Kevin Molino in the preseason and not really replacing him, to Kaká's injuries, to never finding a rhythm really on the attack. Not having that firepower, focusing too much on defense because that was the issue in 2016, and then not enough on offense so that there was too much pressure on defense. So then both were collapsing. Mm-hmm. A lot of things. They brought in Dom Dwyer, which everybody was really excited about, a striker who played for Sporting Kansas City, scores a lot of goals. He had played for Orlando City during its USL years in 2013, and they brought him back in hoping he would spark things. And he got a nose injury and had a surgery on his nose and was out with the U.S. men's national team and came back in. And there was just not a lot of consistency in the group as a whole, and nothing really clicked.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about Kaká. And, you know, MLS teams, rather, are known for attracting older superstars from the best leagues in the world, Kaká being one example. You've also got Andrea Pirlo, Bastian Schweinsteiger, David Beckham, and more. Do you think the league benefits from having these kinds of players?
Yeah, I think there's been a little bit of shift in recent years. They're starting to attract younger players from overseas, but that's definitely the reputation that they've gotten in the past and up until now. And I think that during that time when those players were signed, it benefits everybody from the league, the teams. It was star power, names that people around the world recognized that would tune into MLS and pay attention. But now MLS is here. People around the world know about it now. It's about upping the skill level and the tactics on the field. And so now there's kind of a shift in starting to go after those younger stars. And some younger stars are actually wanting to come here to mm-hmm. not only play in a league that's growing where they could be a superstar on a team, but also live a different lifestyle in the United States as well.
From the team's perspective, too, if you're spending $7 million on one player's salary, I guess you might be thinking, could I spend a little less on one player and you know, get some more talent, some younger talent?
Yeah, so that's been the question all along, because Kaká was the highest paid player in the league, and there was such a disparity between his salary and the rest of the players on the team. And Atlanta United, expansion team this year, came in and proved that you don't need to spend that amount of money on one player. They came in and they have, you know, three stars that are up for not only Newcomer of the Year awards, but MVP awards and, you know, best 9 or best 11 awards. And they spend, I think, $2 million on their top player, $1 million on another player, and then they have another $1 million player and 5 or 6 guys in between the 500,000 to 800,000 range. Mm-hmm. So they went to the playoffs in their first year. They got knocked out earlier than they were hoping to, but they set attendance records. They did all of these things that Orlando City was hoping to do with lesser known faces.
Orlando fans sad to see Kaká go, though?
There's mixed emotion. So because of his high salary, the Orlando City faithful are looking forward to seeing what the club can do for that with that money, because it hasn't worked. They haven't made the playoffs with him the past 3 years. And then there's also the contingency that recognizes who he is and what a legend he is and how special it was to be able to get to see him play in person, and are sad to see that go. And also, he set a really good example for the players on the team. There were some off-field issues among a couple of them this year, and Kaká has always been straight and narrow, really dedicated, focused on taking care of his body, taking care of his responsibilities on and off the field. So you lose that type of personality in the locker room.
Alicia Delgado, if you step back a little bit and look at the league as a whole, you talked earlier about how it's now developing some momentum and younger players who are wanting to come into the league and join some of these teams. I'm wondering, though, about players like a Kyle Larin who might go over to Europe, develop some skills there, and then come back. Are you seeing some of that, like players who are from the United States going overseas and then coming back with that set of skills they've developed in the European leagues over there?
Yeah, so Orlando City actually has an example of that, too, in Jonathan Spector, where he's from the United States, went through youth national teams, played for the U.S. men's national team as well, went and played in England and overseas, and now he signed with Orlando City this year. And there's some other younger example as well. I think Jonathan is 30 or 31 right now. So there's some younger examples, and people caution too not to go over there too soon before you're ready, because what's happened as well is players can go over there and they sit on the bench for years and miss crucial years of development, and then they come back so they can play, but they didn't really gain anything from being over there. So there's definitely a balance there. And there's a lot of players over there that are expressing interest, and you see Orlando City's name and NYCFC's name, typically those two clubs, thrown around with players all the time, whether it's truthful or not, as them using it as a way to negotiate, and because it's interesting place to be.
Okay, so if Orlando loses the likes of Kyle Larin, what kind of player would they need to fill that spot?
They need a goal scorer. They need a goal scorer that can work in likely a two-striker system with Dom Dwyer. So someone dynamic that can play off of Dom, and someone who's strong as well. Kyle's a big guy. He's, 6'2", I think, 6'2", muscular. He's a big striker. So they're definitely going to have to find someone that can come in and replace him.
Are there some names floating around that you've heard?
There's been a couple that have been floating around. I'm not going to go. There's nothing solid yet that I'd like feel comfortable reporting. But there's a couple names from overseas mainly that we've seen so far. There is one older striker, Kenny Cooper, who was in MLS for years, who is on trial with Orlando City right now. But I don't think he would be that type of permanent replacement for him. If they decided that he could bring something to the team, they'd still need someone else.
Does Orlando have enough talent in its roster to compete for a playoff spot next year? Or is it just about the way they play, or do they really need some fresh talent?
Yeah, they really need fresh talent on the attack. They probably need to strengthen up the midfield for sure. Was a weak spot as well now, especially with Kaká gone. They have Yoshimar Yotun. He's a Peruvian player that they brought in the summer window, who has shown incredible skill and tactics, and especially on the ball. So they'll probably build around him. He could stand out as a star next season, but they definitely need some new faces in next year.
What happens to those players if they get cut? Do they just move to another team?
Yeah, they just have to try to find another job. So, most of them are released, or their contracts aren't renewed, options aren't picked up, and you'll see their names with other USL teams. There's a big distinction in USL between independent USL teams and USL teams that are basically the development squad for an MLS team.
So if it's an independent team, those players aren't going anywhere else in that town or wherever they are.
If it's an independent team, they draw bigger crowds because it's usually the only soccer team in the market. They compete like that is the team, like a regular team would compete to win and sign, try to get the best players and all of that. And MLS teams use their USL teams in a different way, so it's not as competitive. job security is not as good. Attendance isn't as good. So it's a little bit different.
Does MLS sometimes bump their players down to USL to get them to improve their skills or something?
Yeah, and that's another thing why they don't sign as many players either, because they leave room to loan. I think Orlando City loaned 8 or 9 players down this year. So some of them go down on season-long loans, the ones that they know are probably bench players every game, might not even work into the game day 18. And they go and they're starters and they play for OCB all year round. And then players who are coming back from injury, they'll play a game or two with OCB before they get back on the MLS roster. So they use it that way as well.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like the owner of the team has a lot of confidence in Jason Christ, but he has a bit of a challenge on his hand to mold the kind of squad that it looks to you like Orlando needs to be.
Yes, but they'll have a lot of resources to work with next year. So the Kaká's salary, $7 million, that's money that they can work with. But he held the maximum budget charge on the salary cap as well, which is just over $480,000. So now they have that and that much salary cap open. And he also held an international spot, and MLS teams get a limited number of those. So they have an international spot open, and he held a designated player spot, which they only get 3 of those. So they have all of that to work with. They'll probably have other players that are going to leave. They got a lot of allocation money coming in through certain trades, last season and during the year. So there's a lot to work with and check out.
The stadium, a little bit smaller as far as capacity. And if you look at attendance, from 2015, I think the average attendance was 32,000, a little more than that. 2017, 25,000. Does it look like they made the right call in building the size stadium that they have?
I think so. There was a lot of talk that it would be too small when they started. And I actually asked, when I did the stadium story, the stadium opening and covered all of that, I asked not only majority owner Flavio Augusto da Silva, but CEO Alex Leitao as well, if they were concerned at all about attendance and not having a big enough stadium. And they said, no, we know this is the size we want. We know we can sell out tickets at this size every game, that we can make money at this size, that we'll have a great atmosphere. We're not worried about expanding at all. If we need to down the road, then we can discuss that with different firms and see if there's a way to expand. But right now, this is the size that we want. So a lot of skepticism going in that it wasn't big enough. But I think seeing this season, the attendance, I think it was fine. It's fine. So they have 18,000 season ticket holders, which is the majority of the stadium. It feels like a lot of those people each game might not come.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll announce sellouts and there'll still be some empty seats there. And of course, the last couple games, they weren't selling it out. So I think it's fine for now.
Alicia Delgallo, Orlando Sentinel sports reporter covering the Orlando City soccer team. Thank you so much for your time.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is brought to you by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Alana Campbell. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Visit us online at WMFE.org. And while you're there, consider making a donation and supporting us during the Silent Pledge Drive. You can also make a contribution to local reporting and coverage of current affairs by calling 1-800-785-2020. Thanks for your support and thanks for listening. I'm Matthew Petty.